Case number 12-5370 et al. Janet Howard, Joyce Meganson, Appellant v. Penny Sue Pritzker, Secretary, United States Department of Commerce. Ms. Bullock for the appellant, Mr. Hudak for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Bullock, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the court-appointed amicus in support of the appellants. When Congress extended Title VII to protect federal employees from discrimination in the workplace, it also enacted a specific statute of limitations that would govern those employees' access to the courts. In this case, it is undisputed that the plaintiff's complaint fell well within and was expressly allowed by that statute of limitations that Congress enacted in Title VII. Yet the district court held that the complaint was time-barred by a separate general statute of limitations governing civil claims against the United States, 28 U.S.C. Section 2401A. The district court's decision should be reversed. Section 2401A cannot apply because it directly conflicts with the specific statute of limitations that Congress enacted to govern Title VII suits by federal employees. The government concedes that 2401A cannot apply where it conflicts with a more specific statute of limitations. Here there is a clear conflict. In Title VII, Congress first requires federal employees to bring their complaints of discrimination to the agency. After 180 days in that process, the employees then are given two options under the statute. They may either continue the administrative process, or they may leave that process and bring suit in federal court. They continue to have these two options available to them up to the point of a final agency decision, and then at that point, they have 90 days in which to bring their complaint in federal district court.
If we agree with you, what would the limit be? In other words, if there is no final agency action, would you be able to bring a lawsuit anytime thereafter?
Well, I would say two things. First is that I don't think that Congress ever expected that agencies would be able to sit indefinitely on a complaint and never reach a final decision. At the point that there is a final decision, then the plaintiff has a very short window of 90 days. But I think it's true that it was part of Congress's intent to allow the administrative process to run its course and to not force private parties into court when they would rather continue in the administrative process.
But don't you think that given how short the time limits are within the administrative process, that suggests also at least a preference for agencies acting promptly?
I think that's correct. And I think that the parallel allowance for private employees is a good example here. Private employees similarly have a six-month period in which they have to give the administrative process a chance to run its course. If after 180 days the EEOC hasn't taken actions that the employee finds appropriate, it similarly has the right to go to federal court. And so government employees and private sector employees have similar and parallel rights under Title VII, and there's no hard outer limit for private employees that would force them to abandon the administrative process early. Similarly, there isn't one in Title VII for federal government employees.
But the government is saying that once that 180 days passes, the cause of action has accrued and the 6 years starts running. That's their argument, isn't it?
Right, that is their argument. But my reply to that is that Congress never intended to impose a hard external barrier on that administrative process.
And we know that because...
Well, I would say two things. One is that for private employees, there's no similar outer bounds on the administrative process. And I think that the Supreme Court's decision in Occidental is informative on that point. The Supreme Court noted there that Congress, when it was enacting Title VII, provided this 180-day opt-out of the administrative process to bring suit in federal court to allow employees to escape from the administrative quagmire, which occasionally surrounds a case caught in an overloaded administrative process. So Congress wanted to give employees options, not to force an artificial deadline on an administrative process that can admittedly be lengthy, but at the same time not to leave employees forced to remain in an administrative process with no end in sight. And so the whole purpose of Title VII was to allow these two parallel processes by which employees can continue their administrative process if they feel like that is moving appropriately. It would be in direct conflict with congressional intent to say at the 6.5-year mark, okay, federal employee, this case may be fully briefed, you may feel like it's going great, but we're going to force you to either leave now prematurely and to avoid losing the right to sue in federal court, or stay in an administrative process with no hope of judicial review, despite the fact that Congress expressly provided that within 90 days after a final agency decision, you could go to federal court. The government's reading of this statute requires that right to go to federal court within 90 days to be read out entirely for any case in which the agency takes longer than 6.5 years. So I would say that because of this conflict, there would be perverse consequences.
So your argument, basically, so I understand, because I'll ask the government, is that when Congress enacted Title VII, and we're talking about federal government employees here, it enacted a scheme that was designed to carry out certain purposes, or a certain purpose that Congress thought was important, and that the Supreme Court has interpreted to preempt other remedies that might otherwise be available. And so the enactment of Title VII itself as to its application to federal employees is, in effect, a clear statement by Congress that this is the scheme and the time limits that apply, not whatever else we may have written at another time?
I think that's precisely right, that Congress was favoring resolution of discrimination claims in an administrative process that Congress knew could be lengthy, but in an effort to avoid trapping employees in that administrative process, it allows them to bring suit in federal court as long as they had given at least 6 months for the agency process to run its course. And so to apply 2401A here would be to create this outer bounds where you're forcing employees to make a choice that Congress never intended, either stay in an administrative process with no judicial review at the end, or abandon a process that the employee could feel like was close to resolution that would work out in their favor.
And if Congress had intended that, it clearly could have said so, as it has said elsewhere. Title V, for example, with regard to federal employees who are under collective bargaining agreements.
I think that's exactly right. Congress knows how to force an agency decision by a certain date if it chooses to do so. It could have said that the agency must resolve discrimination complaints within 3 years, or possibly better, within 2 years or 1 year, but it didn't do that. It recognized that discrimination
claims... Or it could
have
said that you make an irrevocable election.
Pardon me?
Or Congress could have said an employee makes an irrevocable election. You either stay with the administrative system or you go to court.
I think that's exactly correct, Judge. But notably, Congress did not require that. Instead, it expressly allowed the employees to continue to have these two parallel tracks up to the point of a final agency decision.
So the government argues that to adopt your position, we would have to overturn 20 years of precedent because this court has read 2401A to be plain on its face that it applies to all civil actions.
I actually don't think that that's even the government's argument.
Oh,
the
sorry.
Government,
what is it?
The government doesn't claim that 2401A applies to all civil claims. It's undisputed that the Supreme Court has held that it doesn't apply to the Quiet Title Act, which provides a 12-year statute of limitations. It doesn't apply to the Federal Tort Claims Act, which provides a shorter statute of limitations. Even Spanos itself, which is the case that the government is relying on so heavily, noted that there are civil actions in which 2401A does not apply.
I think their argument is that it doesn't apply where there's irreconcilable conflict.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Right? Okay, and so the 12-year statute would obviously irreconcilably conflict. You would be cutting off 6 years that Congress specifically gave them.
That's correct. But I think that the fact that Title VII doesn't count its rights in base of years from filing, but rather marks the statute of limitations by stages of the administrative process, doesn't mean that there's any less of a conflict. To impose this 6.5-year mark as a hard stop on judicial review undermines what Congress clearly thought was important, was that you would be able to get an agency decision and then have the right to have a court review your discrimination complaint as well.
I suppose the one counter to that would be that at least as to the idea of Title VII, it was that we should speedily resolve these issues in the employment sector, right? That we shouldn't let them fester and go on forever. And so there was, I think, a preference toward doing this quickly. And so what this would set up, if you are right, and perhaps you are, would be a sort of unlimited time in which this goes unresolved. And we're looking at a case here that has been going on for 20 years. That's a career.
Yes, Your Honor. I think I would say two things to that. First is that Congress allowed employees to leave the administrative process beginning at the six-month mark, 180 days, precisely because of the concern that you're expressing, that it didn't want employees to be trapped in an administrative proceeding that appeared to be endless. But I would also note that the department that is handling the discrimination complaint is also the defendant in the lawsuits. And so if there's any party that's better suited to speed up the administrative process, it's the federal government as opposed to the employees. But it's unfair here to say that because the administrative process ran long, that the plaintiffs lose their right to court. I would also note that prior to this case, I don't think any court had ever held that 2401A applied to truncate a Title VII statute of limitations. And so it simply is unfair to expect that plaintiffs who were trying to pursue their claims in the manner that Congress preferred before the agency now get punished because of a theory that the government first proposed in 2010.
Want to save the rest of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Counsel for Appley.
Good morning, Your Honors. Brian Hudak from the U.S. Attorney's Office on behalf of the Secretary of Commerce. The panel has correctly noted the key issue in this case is whether the limitation set forth in 2401A, a jurisdictional limitation that this Court has held for over 27 years, conflicts irreconcilably with Title VII's claim-specific defenses under a statute of limitations regime specific to claims under that statute. Here, the two statutes can be read harmoniously, and the Court is thus obligated to read them in that fashion.
Court of Appeals has ever. We didn't just start with Title VII yesterday. What Court of Appeals has ever embraced the notion that 2401 applies to Title VII cases?
That there is currently no circuit precedent.
None. I was blown away, to be very honest with you, so you know where I'm coming from in terms of my concerns. I've never even heard this suggested by anyone because, let me just tell you what my concern is, Congress adopted a specific scheme. It's a policy choice. And they had every reason to understand, and for all the years that Title VII has been in force, they've understood it. They've corrected Title VII here and there as they've seen fit. They have never corrected this process scheme, and they put it in place as it is. There is an irreconcilable conflict if you now impose 2401A on top of this, because the enacted scheme does not close down after 6 years. It's not there.
Your Honor, I would posit that these statutes can be read harmoniously. Simply because they're
harmoniously, they can't be read harmoniously if the enacted scheme does not allow a six-year shutdown. And you're now saying, well, but that's it's not so bad because, as my colleague properly notes, it's nice to move these cases along. And so that's not really irreconcilable. It is irreconcilable.
Your Honor, the court's exclusive remedial scheme jurisprudence that Brown and Preser speak about, or talk about that is when Congress enacts a specific statutory scheme that creates substantive rights, that scheme governs those substantive rights, governs the claim, the cause of action that an employee may bring, Title VII, the CSRA. It doesn't, however, at all purport to eliminate restraints on the judiciary. And that's what 24-1A.
The restraints are explicit in the scheme that's been adopted.
But it doesn't otherwise.
And your premise that 24-1A covers all civil actions is wrong. So that's your starting premise. And there are cases that disprove that. Now, your starting premise is just wrong. And yes, we have precedent that is loose, but has nothing to do with Title VII. Loose in those words and saying that, but out of context. Has nothing to do with Title VII.
Your Honor, the only two mentions where 2401A it doesn't apply to every civil action are Federal Tort Claim, which is 2401B. It's in the same section.
Yeah.
And the Quiet Title Act, which is also found in Title 28, 2409A sub G currently.
Right.
And in that case, the Supreme Court in Block against North Dakota has similarly held that to be a jurisdictional limit on the court's authority. So we're dealing with two jurisdictional limitations, and there's a clear conflict there.
I don't know if 2401 may be jurisdictional. That's beside the point. The question is whether it preempts the scheme under Title VII. It's of no moment that 2401 is jurisdictional where it applies. The Title VII scheme is statutory, is clear, and it is a different scheme than 2401.
But 2401 is not a scheme. It's not a remedial scheme. And I would direct the court.
There are jurisdictional limitations and there are statute of limitations under the Title VII scheme, right?
There are no jurisdictional temporal limitations under Title VII.
Right, because Congress chose to do it that way.
Well, no. To read an implied preemption.
It's not implied. If Congress writes a statute and says, this is not implied, I can't fathom this argument. This is not an implication of what Congress meant to do. Congress says, here's what we meant to do, and we've written it, and we have never amended the scheme. And we understand that sometimes it'll go forever, and sometimes it won't. Private sector, federal sector, it's all the same. And if we want to amend it, we'll amend it. You, the court, should stay out of it.
Your Honor, I, the government disagrees in that, too. Title VII doesn't explicitly render 2401A inapplicable to
it. It doesn't have to.
It's a civil action.
It doesn't have to. It sets up its own limitation scheme.
That doesn't set an outer limit on
claims. The general rule is the specific controls are general. You don't doubt that for a second. So the only fight is whether there's an irreconcilable conflict.
Correct.
And there is.
But there is not, because Title VII does not set an outer limit. Title VII's limitations period.
That's by intention.
But it's also by intention for Congress to have maintained for nearly 140 years an outer jurisdictional limitation on all
claims. But I guess the other part of your argument is that the cause of action accrued in August after that 180-day period.
Yes, Your Honor.
And one of the arguments made is that Congress often pegs a time limit to final agency action, so that even under your argument, this cause of action is timely because Congress said once you get final agency action, you have 90 days to file a civil action in the district court. So your argument would be, well, the outer limit is 6 years, because you say the 90 days is not jurisdictional and the Supreme Court has held it's subject to equitable tolling. In other words, you want to place that 6-year limit prior to the period that Congress set in the Title VII scheme. I think that's what we're trying to understand.
Sure, Your Honor, and I would direct the court to Spanhouse. which dealt with a similar scheme where there was a period of constructive exhaustion that was required by the statute. Mm-hmm. It also allowed a litigant to stay in the administrative process mm-hmm. and pursue a final decision on the FOIA request. Mm-hmm. The court in that case, applying the six-year jurisdictional outer bar, which is, again, Title VII, FOIA is a comprehensive scheme to govern requests for information from the federal government, applied the six-year bar mm-hmm. to and said that the accrual date was on the 20 days of the constructive exhaustion in that case, and that's when it approved first. And again, the 2401 speaks of first accrual, not subsequent accrual. And there's no debate that the action that could have been brought 181 days after the administrative complaint isn't the exact same action that they attempted to bring in 2005.
Does FOIA have the same language that Title VII has?
It's not precisely the same, Your
no,
Honor.
No, I mean this key language that says a civil action may be filed after this final agency action.
It doesn't have that precise language.
And that's the key point, isn't it?
That's the distinction with Spanish.
Your Honor, I don't believe that's the key point because it doesn't say, it says when you can maintain a claim. These are claim limitations, not jurisdictional limitations on the court's authority. And in John R. Sand, the Supreme Court noted that the two are distinct principles.
I know, but we're clear, counsel, that Congress can set a different scheme up.
And it,
right?
Yes, Your Honor, and
right,
in this case.
So FOIA didn't have this scheme.
FOIA had a similar scheme where there was a mandate.
You just told me that it didn't have this language.
It didn't have the precise language, Your Honor.
Saying that when you have final agency action, then you have 90 days to file a civil action in court.
Correct.
So Congress is, in your terms, addressing, quote, my argument, the civil action that 2401 is addressing. But it's saying in this context, we have a different scheme.
Well, Your Honor, I wouldn't say it's having a different scheme. It's saying that there's a flexible statute of limitations under Title VII.
In other words, Congress, when it enacted this, had to say our 90-day limit is meaningless?
No, Your Honor. It's not meaningless at all. It has very important points. If, for instance, claim
under
accrues,
your argument, the 6 years starts after the 180 days expires. And so if the agency takes 8 years to do something and the plaintiff waits more than 90 days, it's still too late.
Your Honor, but I would agree with you in that circumstance is too late, but it's subject to equitable tolling. Your Honor, I would like to note a few.
No, it's not. If you're right that this is jurisdictional, there's no equitable tolling.
Your Honor, that's correct.
You've corrupted the scheme, is what Judge Rogers is talking about.
The government is not corrupting the scheme. Again, Congress chose in 1978, just 6 years after the enactment of Title VII, to create an express exclusion to 2401A. It did so for all claims arising under the Contract Disputes Act, not just those arising in the Court of Federal
Claims.
I think
the other thing that's interesting is that, as you point out in your brief, 2401A is a Tucker Act. I'm suing the government for money. Title VII, as this complaint makes clear, she is asking for back pay, attorney's fees, et cetera, but she's asking for a slew of other things that have nothing to do with money.
Your Honor, it originated with the Tucker Act, correct?
But I'm getting at what Congress was focusing on, that if you're going to sue the government for money, come in 6 years. But Congress says, well, we've got these other issues that we want to address, and we're going to do those slightly differently. And so it enacts, you know, Title VII to address something that has nothing to do with money.
Correct. But in Spanish, applying it to FOIA, FOIA has nothing to do with money.
Mm-hmm.
And that court held that.
But it doesn't have this key language we're talking about.
Well, it doesn't have the precise language. It has the same scheme, though, Your Honor.
It doesn't have the same scheme. That's
what,
the point.
What are you reading?
It has the same claim accrual scheme, that the claim accrues after a period of constructive exhaustion.
It's not the same filing scheme.
Your Honor.
Don't overstate your case. That is just wrong.
It's the same exhaustion scheme. That instead of the APA, instead of claims under the APA where Congress said that if final agency action is necessary to reviewing the claim in court, and that agency...
It has no specific standard of limitation. FOIA does not. This does.
But
they're entirely different. That's what Spanos was addressing.
And
it makes sense that Spanos went the way it did, because that statute had no specific limitation prescription, whereas this does.
But this does not have an absolute outer limit.
So what? That's a framework. It has limitations of various sorts depending upon how the case plays out. And that's what Congress chose to do.
But Congress didn't chose to expressly exempt Title VII from the class of claims that's subject to 2401A. And it just did that later that same decade.
And you know that because...
In reading 2401A, except as provided by the Contracts Dispute Act of 1978,
yeah.
That language, it's that in 1978 to the statute. Same period of time that the 72 amendments to Title VII engrafted this process onto the federal government. But just to correct a couple other notions, it's not the agency that is handling the administrative process here. This is the EEOC. The employing agency, the Department of Commerce, isn't the one that languished in the administrative process.
The EEOC is not a federal agency anymore?
Your Honor, it is a federal agency, but the defending here is the Department of Commerce. It's alleging that commerce officials created an atmosphere of discrimination.
And Commerce had no right
to withdraw from the administrative
Commerce
process.
Commerce couldn't correct that.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Commerce couldn't correct that.
It's an allegation. Commerce doesn't believe that this occurred.
I know it's an allegation, but you're suggesting that the department can't do anything. It just has to sit on its hands, even if it thinks there's some merit to an allegation.
No. In fact, I would argue just the opposite. There's an EEO office within Commerce that's specifically designed. Should they believe that discrimination's at hand, they are charged with eradicating discrimination.
And
the government's not walking back from that at all.
Okay. Don't need to answer.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying it.
But look at what happened in this case.
Sure.
And, you know, I mean, it's been dragged out. There's no question about that. But at the point you would cut it off, EEO's Office of Federal Operations has vacated the dismissal and provisionally certified a class. So now it's going back within the agency to address the merits. But under your scheme, the 6 years has kicked in, and so Mrs. Howard has to abandon that and sue in district court or give up her right to go to district court once she gets a final agency decision on her claim. Now, isn't that changing the scheme?
No, Your Honor. I think it's a harmonious application of the two statutes.
So you just cut her off after the EEOC office says we're provisionally certifying her class?
It's not cutting her off. At that point, she has an election, Your Honor.
Where does it say that?
Where does it say that?
But that's the clear upthrust of applying both statutes in a harmonious fashion to the facts of this case.
If you look at Title V, Congress was very clear where it said you have an election and it's irrevocable. That's not what Title VII says. And you want us to read that in. And all I'm suggesting is that if Congress intended that, it could have said that.
Your Honor, Congress speaks in a lot of different ways.
True.
So to choose how Congress decides to express its intent is difficult. But I'll note here on the specific...
How has everybody missed this up until now?
Your Honor, I don't think everyone's missed it. I believe...
Oh, really? What Court of Appeals has bought it?
I believe the Third Circuit, there's a case pending before the Third Circuit with this exact same issue.
No, but
Your
it's
Honor.
Interesting, I'll just tell you as a member of this court, how many times 2401A has appeared in the government's brief this term. All right? I've been on this court a long time. This argument, it's fine. You may win. But I'm just saying, it's a new approach that the government
everyone has missed it up until now.
Yes.
Your Honor, I don't think everyone's missed it up until now. But I would also just want to note, under the facts in this case, there was no final agency decision as contemplated by Title VII. The employing agency, Commerce, never issued a decision. So we're under the 180-day regime. And in that circumstance, Title VII provided no outer limit.
So when they dismissed her claim, that wasn't final agency action?
The Commerce never dismissed her claim.
Who dismissed it?
The EEOC ALJ ceased the hearing on her claim by dismissing the hearing. It then would have returned to Commerce to implement a final agency decision. That did not occur because she filed suit in district court under the 180-day provision.
My notes are wrong where I said at JA233, I thought that on September 30th, the ALJ dismissed her class claim. And then she filed suit on October 5th.
Yeah, Your Honor, I think what I'm saying and what you are saying is exactly, is so to be harmonized, is that the EEOC, the ALJ, dismissed the claim because Ms. Howard and the other plaintiffs.
So what was left before the agency?
The agency could have done anything it wanted.
Oh, I know, but you just told me, all right, that this is all being handled by the EEOC. So they dismiss her claim.
Right, but then there has to be a final agency decision. This court noted that difference.
So when the Commerce EEOC.
It's not Commerce EEOC. This is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. It's a hearing before the EEOC trial level. After a decision of that body is issued, it goes back to the agency.
Where does Title VII say a final agency action only occurs after a trial?
It doesn't, Your Honor. That's not what I'm saying, Your Honor.
No, it says final agency action. Her claim has been dismissed by the very office that has to adjudicate it.
No, Your Honor. That's where I think the disconnect is. The EEOC hearing.
Yeah.
For example, in an individual Title VII plaintiff, the EEOC ALJ can find discrimination. That's not the final agency decision because it goes back to the employing agency, and the employing agency at that moment has the ability to accept the ALJ's determination or reach a different determination based upon the record.
So when the district court denied your motion to dismiss on the grounds that Mrs. Howard had failed to exhaust, it rejected that argument, didn't it?
No, Your Honor.
Well, you filed a motion to dismiss on many grounds, but one of them was that she had failed to exhaust.
Well, the fail to exhaust was the fail to timely bring an administrative complaint of discrimination within the 45-day window under the EEOC's regulations.
Where did you argue in the district court that there was no final agency action when the ALJ dismissed the class claim, and therefore, I don't know what your therefore is.
Your Honor, we did it in the briefing on the motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction.
I read it. That's why I made my notes. And now you're telling me that was not final agency action.
It was not final agency action as contemplated by
the district court. Did you present that argument to the district court?
Your Honor, I believe we didn't.
It denied your motion to dismiss. That's the bottom line here.
Oh, Beck, we didn't argue the 2401A jurisdictional.
You didn't argue it. That's
correct, because it's a jurisdictional limit. Your Honor, we were obliged to raise this to the court. The court is bound to consider its jurisdiction at all phases of the action.
Of course, you can raise whatever you want before the district court. But this argument you're making this morning, I did not find in your motion to dismiss. I may have missed it, but I didn't find it. I thought all of your arguments about jurisdiction were on other grounds. That's the only point I'm trying to make here. So if you can find it, I'd appreciate your giving me the record cite.
Your Honor, our briefing on the motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction is not in the joint appendix.
I know. I pulled it up off the docket.
So I do not have it before?
Yeah. Okay.
Stay, Your Honor. But
at any rate, I didn't find it in your brief either, but that's another issue. So why don't you proceed with the rest of your argument because you're out of time.
Sure. I would be happy to supplement and direct the court through a notice to where we argue that below if the court was so interested.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Okay. Counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Do you remember seeing this in your review of the record, this argument that after the ALJ had dismissed the class complaint, there was still something pending before the agency because the Department of Commerce had not taken final agency action?
Your Honor, I think that I couldn't point you to a specific page where that occurs, but I think the important point is that it doesn't actually matter here whether or not there was a final agency decision or not. Because regardless, the government doesn't contend that the suit was untimely under Title VII, whether there was a final agency decision or not before the complaint was filed, the suit was still timely because it did not exceed the 90 days past a final agency decision. If the final agency decision hadn't been given, then you were still within the, after 6 months, you can opt out and go to federal court window. So I think that the court needn't reach that question if it doesn't want to. I would make three quick points. The first is that the government doesn't provide any support for its theory that Title VII is somehow inadequate for failing to have a jurisdictional outer limit on the time to bring suit. It doesn't provide any cases that say that there has to be one for suits against the government.
I know, but all I'm getting at, they're arguing it now, so we have to decide it.
Which part, Your Honor?
No, I mean, the fact there are no cases, that doesn't help me, if I can put it that way.
Yes, but my point was just that Title VII does provide an outer limit. Whether it's jurisdictional or not, shouldn't bother the court because it does set a hard outer limit of 90 days after a final agency decision. But I think that it's important here that no circuit has ever held that 2401A does apply to truncate Title VII in the way that the government is now contending. And with regards to Judge Brown's concern earlier about administrative delay, I would just note that Congress has the ability to insert a hard stop on the process if it were to find that that was a problem. For these reasons, we would ask that the district court's decision be reversed.
All right. Thank you. Take the case under advisement.